குட் மார்னிங். ஸ்ரீ அன்னை பகவான் ஸ்ரீ அரவிந்தர் அப்பா தவ திரு கர்மயோகி அவர்களின் பாதாரவிந்தங்களில் பணிந்து இன்றைய நாள் நிகழ்ச்சியை துவங்குகிறோம். இன்று லைஃப் டிவைன் வெப் மீட்டிங் நடக்க இருக்கிறது. இன்றைய டாபிக் தி அசன் டுவர்ட்ஸ் சூப்பர் மைண்ட். மிஸ்டர் கேரி சார் அவர்களும் மிஸ்டர் சந்திரசேகரன் அவர்களும் பேச இருக்கிறார்கள். நவ் ஐ ஆம் இன்வைட்டிங் மிஸ்டர் கேரி to start this speech.
Good morning. This is the 54th chapter. In the last chapter, he talked about the triple transformation. The psychic transformation, where we go inside and discover the psychic and bring the psychic influence out to the surface to purify, refine, and open the surface being so that the spirit can descend. That's the spirit rising up to become conscious in the spiritual planes, and the spirit coming down. That's the spiritual transformation. And with this chapter, he starts the supramental transformation. Sri Aurobindo says that it took him, he knew that the supermind existed. Vivekananda had pointed to the supermind when he was in Alipur jail. He saw it in vision. But the rishis, the yogis were not reaching supermind, they were reaching moksha. How to reach that supermind? It took him 12 years to work out the method, because when mind tries to reach the infinite, it loses itself. And there he discovered the secret of the ascending planes of consciousness, the stairway of ascent, by which mind can ascend to the higher planes of mind without losing contact with the world. Mother says that with all her spiritual experiences, she never lost contact with the outer world. Whereas in tradition, the spiritual experience starts when you lose contact with the world. And so world and spirit seem to be two different things. You can have one or the other. But Sri Aurobindo knew for the transformation of life on earth, you can't leave life in order to save life. You have to bring the spirit into life. And he discovered that method of ascent. He's described it in very great detail in book two of Savitri. He described it in Life Divine Part 1 in summary as the ascending series of substance. In this chapter, he describes in detail the planes above thinking mind, higher mind, illumined mind, intuitive mind, over mind, that are the pathway and the channel between supermind and mind. They're the pathway for the ascent, and they're the pathway for the descent of the supramental consciousness. And he walks us through that process. Next week, we have been preparing at MSS for a conference in Croatia on the topic of mind, thinking, and creativity. To humanity, mind is, we can almost say mind is divine. For those who don't have direct spiritual experience, mind is a standing miracle. Because everything that distinguishes us from the rest of the life on the planet is because we have mind. And if you think about what's the difference between man, human beings, and all the other species, there are several factors that distinguish us. The first is, man is the tool maker. Man is the first animal who discovered ways to create tools and use tools in order to make him more effective. So they've traced back that the first making of a stone axe, something that you can use for hunting or fighting or digging or breaking things or cutting wood or opening a coconut, it goes back about 2 million years before our species, but the earliest primitive forms of man were there. The first needle is about 50,000 years ago. Well, what's the big deal about a needle? Until man invented needle, found a way to make a needle out of a wood or whatever he did, he could not live in cold climate. Because the climates are so cold that even if you have fur, unless you can stitch it and close it up and make it completely tight, you can't. So it's only about 50,000 years ago that human beings came out of Africa and the southern climates and went into the northern climates because they had invented this device that they could make very warm, close-fitting clothes. So man, the tool maker, is unique. And today, we can't live without our tools, whether it's the mixie or the cell phone or the computer or the pen or whatever it is. We are constantly using tools. Man is unique in another way, and we are the symbol maker. We're the only animal who creates symbols for things. Symbols that we can see, like images, like a mother symbol, or the figure of a goddess or a god that painted on the wall. Symbols like the sound om, which is a symbol for the whole power of creation that creates the universe. It's a symbol. It's not a visual symbol. It's a sound symbol. We're the first that creates language, words, ideas, even written letters. We have money, which absolutely has no value in itself, but it's a symbol of something, and we use it and we value it as if it's gold. These are all symbols. We're the only animal that creates symbols. We're the only animal, with a few rare, very limited exceptions, that builds. We're the builder. We create monuments, we create houses, we create cities, we create cathedrals, churches, temples, we create airports, space stations, we create all types of things. No other animal does more than a bird creates a nest. That's about the limit. We're the only animal that observes and thinks very carefully about nature. So early man observed and watched nature for tens of thousands of years and finally figured out how nature grows food. To us, we take it for granted because we've learned it, we were told. But it took tens of thousands of years for human beings to figure out, first of all, that the food comes from a seed. Secondly, that the seed needs water, it needs sunlight, it needs to be in a particular type of soil, it needs to be planted at a particular season and harvested at a particular season. All of these things, which are obvious to us now, even if we're not farmers, it was not obvious for tens of thousands of years, but we had watched nature, we have imitated nature, and we have improved on nature, so we grow much, much more food than nature ever grew before we started agriculture. And that's the basis of our civilization. And the highest thing, we do many other things. We're the organizer. Our minds organize everything. We create laws. We create cities. We create institutions. We create trade. We create governance. We create education. We create centers, book sales. We do so many things. But the most unique thing about us is that we create concepts. We create thoughts. We create ideas to represent reality. So if an animal, any animal were in the room watching us now, this curious thing, what are all of these other animals doing? What are we all doing? Listening to this sound coming out of my mouth. What are we looking at? What are we listening to? Why are we doing this? They won't understand that each sound has a unique significance. Each word has so much of meaning behind it. We create not only words for things like a phone or food or water, we create words for ideas like aspiration. Try communicating and explaining to an animal what aspiration is, or delight, or infinity, or eternity. These are not physical things. We create all of this through our mind. So it's natural for human beings, for the average human being, looking back on the last thousands of years and seeing how much humanity has done. We have built the cities, we have discovered science, we have created knowledge, we've created education, we've created cell phones and computers and all of this. And all of this has been done by our mind. At least we think that way. So naturally, mind is the ultimate. And we must be so proud of mind. We should be worshiping mind as God. And in fact, the materialist, the scientist, though the atheist who has not discovered that there is really a God, they do worship mind as God. They do think this is the ultimate. And Sri Aurobindo says even the rishis, even the great yogis who have experienced the self, who know the Brahman, they know that Brahman is the source of everything. But they also thought that mind is the last step in the evolution. And beyond mind, the only thing beyond mind is to go for moksha. There's nothing they could conceive of beyond mind itself. So having climbed up from the mud, having become life, having come out and become mental human beings, the next thing for us is go to moksha. So what a discovery to know that mind is only one more step in the evolutionary chain. It's not the end. It's not the limits of our power. We need not stop here. It's not that we have a choice, either stay here or jump off the cliff or leave the universe. This is an adventure, an infinite adventure. And the spirit that has become matter, the spirit has become life, the spirit has become mind, has infinite powers for manifestation and creation that it's not shown yet. This is not the end of the journey. We are only somewhere midway. But this is a very significant step in the journey, because up until now, nature has been evolving by itself. We have not done anything particular. The animal, the life, the plants that came out of matter didn't do anything. It just happened. The animals that came out of the plants just happened. Maybe man started to do something because we've worked a lot and explored and everything, but still we're unconscious. We still don't know how we created mind. We know what mind is created, but we don't know what mind is. The psychologists don't know what mind is today. The neuroscientists don't know what mind is. They are only using mind. They are not a knowing mind. So it's natural that we are the first species that can become conscious of what we are, conscious of what we, where we have come from, and also conscious of the future and our future destiny. So we are the first animal capable of self-consciousness. We're capable of looking in ourselves and discovering, I'm not just this, there's more. There's more. There's much, much, much more than what we have. And because we become self-conscious, we're capable of evolving much, much faster than life has evolved up until now. If it took billions of years for matter to become life, and a few billion years for life to become animals, and it's taken at least a few million years for the most developed animal to become the modern human being, he says instead of millions or billions of years, now that we're conscious, we can do it much faster. What we have done in billions of years, we can do in a few thousand years. And if there's really an intense aspiration, it can be done in a few hundred years. We can rapidly abridge. You know how long it took? Imagine a person who want to travel 1,000 years ago. If you want to travel from Chennai to New York, it'll take or to walk from here to Delhi, like Shankara did. We're talking what would take years and years and years. Now it's a question of 12 hours on the plane. Everything is abridged. Our evolution also can be abridged. So this chapter talks about those next stages and levels of the evolution. And he tells us, we know that there's something more. We already know that there's something above there. First of all, we all believe there's something called genius. And we know rare individuals, they may not have been spiritual individuals, but rare individuals whose power of mind went way beyond what we have. Like Ramanujam. Ramanujam became one of the greatest, maybe the greatest mathematician of the 20th century, born here in Tamil Nadu. He never had a real formal education. And when he went to Cambridge and they were studying what he did, they said, how did you come up with these complex theorems, these formulas and everything? How did you solve these problems? We've been working on them for decades. He said, I didn't solve them. I saw the answer. They couldn't believe it because he didn't use the thinking mind. He wasn't a smarter mental person. He had direct vision of a higher knowledge. We even wonder in a more simple way when we study Jane Austen, a 19-year-old girl writing this story, and the more we study the detail and insight and magnificence and complexity of this story, it looks to be a miracle. How could anybody have written this? And we know, we're fairly sure, if we had called her and asked her to explain, she won't be able to tell us. She had an intuition or an illumination or an insight that she herself didn't understand where it came from. And if we try to construct it, we won't be able to construct what she has done so perfectly, so magnificently. So we know there are levels of genius. And in India, we know that genius is not the highest level of the rare individual. There's the sage who has a wisdom that no human being is born with. There's the seer who can see truths, who can hear truths that nobody knows, that nobody can, you can't construct it as a thought. There are the yogis, there are the rishis. So we know, as a rare individual, there are people like this. But what Sri Aurobindo is telling us in this chapter is, This is our future destiny. Each of these levels, the higher mind, the illumined mind, the intuitive mind, the overmind, is a pathway up in our ascent to supermind. Every one of us is destined to make that ascent. Maybe not all in this life, that would be wonderful. Maybe it, in 100 lives, whatever it may be. But he also tells us, as he told us in earlier chapters, that each soul, we have started out in matter. We have started out in the plant life. We have started and moved up through the animal life to the human level over so many births, over so many thousands of years. This is our future pathway, but it need not take thousands of years and thousands of births. It can be done. He says it can be done in one lifetime. And that is the destiny, that the human species can evolve to these higher levels, even in one lifetime. And that has not happened yet. That is what Mother and Sri Aurobindo came to create the path for. And he says, he asked the question, well, what will happen to humanity if all of the humanity is destined to go to supermind and overmind? What will happen to humanity? This is a pathway. What happens to the 10th standard teacher when students go to the 11th standard and the 12th standard, or they go to the college, or they go to the university, or they go out in the light? Other students are coming. It's a pathway. As the grade school from kindergarten up is a pathway for education, the life from the plant to the animal to the human to the seer and all these other stages is the pathway for the soul in its ascent, in its great adventure of consciousness and joy. And they have come because so far the souls have been coming to mind, and then they've been leaping off the cliff and going for moksha. And he's been saying, no, you're missing the point. The pathway goes higher. It doesn't end here. This is not the end. If this was the end, it would be a very disappointing story. This would be like ending the story when Wickham elopes with Lydia. We'd miss the finale. The real good part of the story only comes later. This is the rest of the story. When we try to understand where we're going from here, it's helpful to understand where we've come from. It's helpful to understand how where we're going is going to be different from where we've come from. We have been living in what he calls ignorance, which is a world in which our knowledge is a knowledge of division. It's everything separate from everything else. I feel separate from everybody around me. I feel separate from the world. I feel my mind is separate from my heart, from my vital, from my physical. They're all different things to us. The surface of the person is separate from the inner person. God is somewhere else, separate. We are divided from everything. That's the ignorance. Where we're going as we ascend these planes is to more and more see there is no real division. Everything is connected, integrated, united with everything else. Until, that is, when the psychic comes forward, the separation between the surface personality, the ego, and the soul disappears. The surface personality becomes the expression of the soul. When the psychic comes forward, the vital, the mental, the physical become harmonized with each other instead of each one going in their own direction and quarreling with them or everything. They become harmonized and unified. The higher we go, instead of feeling separate from everybody else and often in conflict with everybody else and wishing that everybody else would do what we want them to do, we come more and more into harmony with everybody else until we finally realize realize not as an idea, realize as an experience that that's me. Oh, you're me, me, me. We are all one. There's a oneness in all of us. And we begin to live not just in harmony, we begin to live in the sense of oneness. And when we go higher still, we discover that even this thing we call God, the divine, the transcendent, is not something other than us at all. It's our true self. And so the transcendent, the cosmos, the universe, and the individual become united. So up until now, what we call knowledge has been a knowledge based on division, where everything's separate. And where the knowledge that he's talking about in this chapter is a knowledge of integration. We are more and more discovering the links and interconnectedness until we finally reach supermind, where there's only one. Not one alone, left in a closet, all by itself. One in the midst of many that knows the many as itself. The world and the divine, the transcendent and the universal and the individual are all conscious of their oneness, and that's our destiny. We can have the highest spiritual realization, we can know the absolute, but we will also know the world and know ourselves as individual. So the ascent is towards integration. I hope the word is clear. For him, it's a very important word, not the dictionary definition, because we don't really have that concept very clearly defined, but he does. Everything is an expression of one, and everything is essentially united with everything else. But as we go up, something else happens, very important, and that is, for us, having a knowledge doesn't necessarily give us power. When we talk about knowledge, we say, now I understand. Now I understand why I'm having so many problems. Now I understand why that man is succeeding and I'm failing. Now I understand why America is more prosperous than India. But that's only information for us. We can have information. But when he uses the word knowledge, he's not talking about understanding. He's not being able to talk about, give a lecture on spirituality. He's talking about knowledge that is power. The higher planes are not just ways in which we become very, very informed, like encyclopedia. With each level, we acquire the power of that knowledge, the power to make it real in life. And we have seen that. All devotees have seen that. Not only when we call Mother and we see there's a power that acts in life, but even what Appa's been talking about, what he calls life response. We understand when we get the key, when we understand the source of our problem, we not only understand it, we get the power to remove it. We get the power to convert the problem into an opportunity. This is knowledge that is power. So keep in mind as we talk about the ascent, that at every level where he uses the word knowledge, he's really talking about power. Power to accomplish whatever we want. Power to determine. Power to realize whatever we aspire for. That's what he means by spiritual knowledge. It's not the knowledge of a philosophy. It's not metaphysics. It's not that we can give lectures on life divine. It's that we have the power of creation because we have the consciousness, the knowledge of the consciousness that's created. I've been mentioning in the recent talks the story by Jules Verne, Around the World in 80 Days, and Appa has been discussing it very much. I think he must be writing about it in Tamil also, because it's the more we study it, the simple story, the more I see the great value in this story. I'm going to repeat what you've all heard. This man, simple gentleman, there's a discussion among four gentlemen in his club about how long it would take to go around the world. Some newspaper has calculated that if you think about how long it takes to go from train by train from London to Manchester, or from Paris to Madrid or whatever, or from Bombay to Calcutta, and you figure out how long it goes by ship from Bombay or from Calcutta to Hong Kong, or Hong Kong to Yokohama, or Yokohama to San Francisco, if you add all of those up, it comes to 80 days. It's simply a mathematical calculation because they know the routes. And he said, yes, it's possible to go around the world in 80 days. And everybody said, everybody else at the table, that's a theoretical calculation. That assumes that there's no storms on the way that blow your ship off course. That assumes that every train runs on time. And that was 120 years ago. Even now the trains don't run on time. So what are the chances of that? That assumes that you're not attacked by Indians, American Indians on the way across the U.S., or there's a cyclone that stops all of the trains, or anything else. Or there's no strike or any other problem. He says, no, everything taken into account, it can be done in 80 days. And he makes the wager, risking everything to do it. How could he say that? None of them are able to understand how he could say that. Has he studied? Has he done a lot of calculations? Did he have a computer 140 years ago? Does he know some secret shortcut so it you can skip India and go around quickly and save a week or two? How could anybody say that? The truth is, he could say that not because he calculated, not because he had a book that told you the train schedules and the ship schedules, but because he had a knowledge that was power. This is not the knowledge of mind. This is the knowledge of the psychic or of the higher mind that because it believes, it can do it. Because, not because he's calculated and he knows more information than other people or shortcut, because that consciousness has the power to make it happen. This is the knowledge that Sri Aurobindo's talking about. A consciousness that is the power not to know something there, but to will something and make it happen. Because the outer world is determined by our consciousness. So up until now, the whole quest of humanity for knowledge for thousands and thousands of years has been to seek and find that knowledge out here, collect it. Put it in libraries, write books about it, encyclopedias, put it on the internet. We're collecting so much of knowledge, and now our computers are collecting millions of pages of knowledge every day and putting it, storing it as if it's precious. He said, that's not the knowledge we're talking about. I'm talking about the knowledge that's inside, the knowledge that's power to do anything. So instead of seeking knowledge, as we go up to the higher planes, knowledge comes to us. Up until now, we are the seekers of knowledge, and no species has sought knowledge the way we do. We have our universities, we have our research institutes, we have our measuring instruments, we're constantly recording everything, we're observing everything, we're trying to discover knowledge out there. But he says, this is knowledge that comes of itself. So instead of being knowledge that's divided, it's knowledge that's integrated. Instead of being knowledge separate from power, it's knowledge that is power. Instead of being knowledge that we hunt for and seek for with our mind, it's knowledge that comes to us. And these are the stages that he's talking about. These are the stages in which, instead of man becoming the discoverer, man becomes the creator. Because we become the creative consciousness that's created the universe. Well, we already know the first stages of the process. We know, he told us last time, we have to break down the wall between the outer, our surface ego, go inside, discover the inner mind, the inner vital, the inner physical, and finally go and discover the psychic. We've got to bring that psychic influence out. We've got to call to the spirit above, rise up to the higher spiritual consciousness, and bring that down into ourselves, into our mind, heart, and body. And this process he has described, even in the opening canto of Savitri in the Symbol Dawn, we had a long discussion with Appa last week. The Symbol Dawn describes the call awakening in humanity from below, out of the inconscient, and the dawn coming in response to that call. The dawn is the light, the spiritual light coming. There's a call is buried deep inside us when we're thinking about all mundane things, about the shopping and the dinner and the vacations and the money and all of those things. Something in us deep inside has an aspiration and is calling. And it's that call of the earth, of humanity, that has bringing down the response from above. And this same process, which he describes in very minute detail, I was thinking maybe sometime we can have a discussion on the Symbol Dawn and what he really is saying there. It's so powerful when you see line by line what he's saying. This is the whole process of the universe. From the beginning of Earth, there has been a call in the inconscient. There has been a response from the superconscious. The only difference now is we can be conscious of the call. We can call consciously. The stone could not call consciously. The flower could not call consciously. The other animal could not call consciously. So it took a long time. We can call consciously and make that process go much faster. This is a theme we all know, because he's been telling us constantly, there are only two things that can achieve the great task before us. The ardent aspiration from below, and the call of the grace from above. This is not new. This is the process that's been there all the time. But our job is to make that call as conscious as possible, because then it can go as quickly as possible. He says, so there are two conditions for this ascent. It's the same ascent, but we're going to do it consciously and we're going to do it quickly. There are two fundamental conditions. The first is, he calls it the law of participation. There's something we should do from our side. There's a personal effort necessary from the human side for this to happen. We are to become conscious instruments. We're not just to be there and something's going to happen to us and we're going to be super mentalized. I think there were people in the ashram in the early days who thought just because they're there in the ashram that everything's going to be done and they're going to be super mentalized and they'll be immortal. But Sri Aurobindo says very clearly in his book, little book, The Mother, that when he talks about surrender, he's not just talking about lying down and saying, I give up, Mother, you do everything. That's, he said, a passive inertia can never be surrender. He calls for an active surrender. From our side, there's something we should do. We should call. We should aspire. And then that's the first condition. And then when the divine responds to that, if that's the law of participation, the other is the law of surrender. When the higher comes, we should surrender to it. And in between the call and the surrender, there's a very, very important step. Rejection. Our job, if we want to go to where we should go, to where we can go, to our own higher being, it's not enough that we call. We have to give up what we already have. We have to give up what we cling to, what we're proud of. The mind cannot rise beyond the thinking mind as long as I'm very proud of my thinking. As long as I think that my thoughts are truth and knowledge. I've read Life Divine. I read the Life Divine. I understood the chapter. If I read Life Divine, understand the chapter, and feel very proud of it, finished. It's over. My knowledge is over. Real knowledge comes only when I understand that. Only when I understand that understanding is not knowledge. If I've really gotten the knowledge from the chapter of Life Divine, I'd be full of power. I'd be full of inspiration. My life will be different. My mind will be silent. Because what he's telling me in Life Divine in every chapter is, mind is an instrument of ignorance. So if I say I've really understood Life Divine, I will stop thinking. I will try to give up the thinking. I will try to go beyond it. In every chapter of Life Divine, he's telling me, your ego is not yourself. The goal is to give up the ego. But I spend all of my time trying to make my ego more successful. I want to be more popular, more successful, satisfy my desires and every. And I say, I understood Life Divine and very well. I've not understood anything. As long as I continue to think that my life is to make my ego more important, I have not understood anything of Life Divine, even though I've read it, even if I can give lectures on it. So I must be willing to reject that which is lower so that the higher can come. Grace is willing to come. We think, oh, Divine is very far away and I have to call very loud and how many times I have to repeat thousands and millions of times in order for the Divine, who's not listening properly up there. Mother is busy with other people and she's not giving me the attention I deserve. We think that it requires so many calls. It's not the call. Mother is there trying to answer every minute, and every time she answers, we go for the mango or for the sadi or for something else, because we're seeking something else. So in the book, The Mother, he gives that list of the things to be rejected. And when you see that list, the things in the mind to be rejected, I have to give up doubt. How to give up doubt? My whole mind is full of doubts. I have to give up opinions. How to give up my opinion? I know, you're wrong, I'm right. How to give up my opinion? I'm asking you, you should accept my opinion, my point of view. You should appreciate my point of view. When I think of all the things I should give up my desires, my preferences, my self-importance, my pride, my prejudice, my jealousy, my envy, and all of those beautiful things that he describes there, mentally, vitally, physically, attachments, and so forth. If I give all of that, then what's left? It's empty. There'll be nothing left. The house will be empty. It's like asking people to come and take away everything I have. Then I'll be left with nothing. But the truth is, the spiritual truth is, the more we give away, the more will come. Only thing is, we're giving away fruits and vegetables, and what's coming is divine consciousness and infinite power. So between the law of participation and the law of surrender, there's a lot of work to be done. Our job is not to, how can I get supermind? How can I get truth? Where can I seek for it? Where can I search for it? That's not our job. The truth is ready to come. We have to stop chasing it away. We have to stop filling our minds full of all things that are not true. And the very definition of this supramental truth, truth consciousness, is the knowledge we want, the knowledge we want that's power, is, he calls it, truth consciousness. Yes, and I say I've been meditating every day and I really want this truth consciousness and I'm finding it very difficult. I think it's not something I can do in a lifetime. It may take so many lives, Sri Aurobindo has said, but it's really very difficult. As long as I speak a lie, I am chasing the truth consciousness away. Truth consciousness means truth. My job is I shouldn't speak something false. I shouldn't think something false if I want the truth consciousness to come. It supermind is not far away. Mother and Sri Aurobindo are just there, just over the border in the subtle physical plane. They have all the truth. They're ready to give it to us. But we have to stop spoiling it each time. That's the message in this ascent. The ascent is not that difficult. The ascent is difficult because we're very happy with what we have and we like it and we cling to it. There's a line in Savitri where Sri Aurobindo says that the seer and the sage and the yogi, they, what is the word he used? I forgot it. He used a particular word. I forgot it. I find it somewhere in my notes. They shrink from the delight. The yogi, when the touch of the divine light comes, delight comes, even the seer, the yogi, the sage, they shrink from it. They're content. We're content with very small satisfactions. We feel comfortable. So I'm a simple man. I don't have big aspirations. Let me just have something small, convenient, something I'm comfortable. That's all right. As long as I'm comfortable. Even the yogis are comfortable. Even the yogis are comfortable where they are. If he knows more than we know, he feels proud of it and he's comfortable there. Our only obstacle is our sense of satisfaction and our not wanting to go have more. The divine is willing to give everything. So the pathway of ascent is we must participate. We must aspire. Aspiration, we must be willing to give up the things that are keeping it in the way. As long as I want to triumph over somebody else or dominate over somebody else, I cannot find the divine. My ego, I only get my ego and more of my ego. It's simple. And then surrender. So aspiration, rejection, and surrender. I think way back in 1972, when I first met Appa, or early 73, he wrote a paper on this, or he gave a talk on it, just a spontaneous talk, not a prepared talk. And we recorded it. I think it's a paper on KYNET, if I'm not mistaken. Aspiration, rejection, surrender. It's the formula. 40 years later, I still see it's the same essential truth that's there in Life Divine. Okay, so we're going to climb the world stair. We're going to climb up and try to understand something about what's beyond mind. What is the powers and levels beyond mind? And of course, it's not easy for us to understand because we're not there. For the person who doesn't think, who only has desires, it's very difficult to imagine thinking. I can't imagine what Ramanujam was doing when he was seeing visions of these mathematical equations. That's beyond me. But anyway, he gives us some idea of what this ascent is. He tells us the process, but he also describes it. And if you really want the good description, the best description in the world, it's there in Savitri. Because there Sri Aurobindo describes his own experiences. Here we're describing it as a philosophy. There he describes it as an experience, what it's like to go to higher mind, what it's like to go to the illumined mind, what is the experience when you're in the intuitive mind and in the overmind, because they are not just states of consciousness, they're worlds. They are planes of existence. They have not only knowledge, they have power. They have not only power, they have beauty. Incredible beauty that far exceeds anything we know. They have delight. Incredible delight that exceeds anything we can imagine. So these are experiences as we go up. And as we go up, there's a noticeable change at each step. Right now, things are very gross, concrete. Matter in the material world is something very concrete and gross. As we go up to these different planes, the world itself becomes more subtle. And by subtle, it doesn't mean that it's nebulous or vague or intangible. It's very real and very intense, but it's not rigid and fixed. Things are more plastic. Here, if I bump my arm or leg against something, it hurts because everything's stiff and rigid. There, everything is more flexible, plastic. It can change. Here, this microphone's going to look the same way for years and years and years. There, forms can change their appearance. They're not limited and fixed to one thing. We ourselves, our forms themselves can change with our consciousness, for example. This is a world where everything is separate from everything else. He calls it infinite divisibility. There is a world where even though there are many things, they're all connected. They're indivisible. Even when they're many, we are all aware that we're indivisible. In other words, this is a world of separation where everything is separate from everything else. That's a world where everything is unified with everything else. This is a world where we're ignorant, looking for some knowledge with a lot of darkness around, like what's going to happen an hour from now? What? What's going to happen? What are you going to say 2 hours from now? Who's going to call? Who's going to visit? What's going to be on the TV? What are you going to read in the newspaper? All of that's just a complete mystery to us because we are ignorant seeking knowledge. The higher we go, the more everything, not only what's here in this room, but what's happening all over the world, not only what's happening now, but what's going to happen in the future, everything will reveal itself more and more. And instead of feeling, I hope nothing goes wrong, I hope it doesn't rain or there's not traffic or there's no power cut or something like that, we go more and more from the sense of helplessness or dependence or hoping to having the power to determine what happens until nothing can happen that's out of our reach, out of our consciousness. This is what happens as we ascend to the different, the higher planes of power. So let's start with the higher mind. And I'm going to just touch a few points, and I hope that Chandrasekhar is going to go and give you some good examples. In fact, some examples from Sri Aurobindo with some of the experiments he did personally, which are quite fascinating. He says that the higher mind is the mind of truth thought. There are still thoughts in the higher mind. But there's a difference. We construct thoughts. We create thoughts. We try to fashion and figure out something, and then we create a thought to express it. And because we're ignorant, our thoughts reflect that ignorance. These are not the thoughts in higher mind are not what we create or construct or search for. They're thoughts that come from themselves. And they don't come from the ignorance, they come from above. They're true. So this is a plane where we still have thought, but not my ignorant thought, I think this is what happened, or I think this is what we should do, or I think that's the solution. This is a thought that comes from above, which is a true in itself. It doesn't mean that in the higher mind you have knowledge of everything. But whatever thought comes from above is itself true. It may be true in a limited area, but it's true. This is the power of the higher mind, and the key for rising from the thought mind, from our thinking mind to the higher mind, is we have to stop thinking. You remember first rule of psychic education? I think I mention it almost every month because it made such a big impression on me when I first read it. First rule of psychic education, give up faith in the mind's externalized way of seeing things. Give up faith in our opinion. Give up faith in our understanding. Give up reliance on, if I can only have time, let me think about it, I'll figure out the answer. Give up faith in that and call for truth to come. Oh, that man's put me in a hot spot. Let me figure out a clever answer so I can defend myself or I can get what I want. I will only get more ignorance. But when I'm in a hot spot, when nothing will work, grace comes, you know, really grace comes to us when we get impossible situations with impossible people where there's no solution. That's really the grace.
Sri Aurobindo says that it took him 10 years to reach Supermind, while he reached Satchidananda in no time. Why this great delay to reach the Supermind when Satchidananda was reached in no time?
Well, I'm not quite sure who reached Satchidananda in no time. I haven't had that experience. And I don't know that Sri Aurobindo reached it in no time, so I'm a bit confused by that question. But I have an answer, even if that's true, I have an answer. That Satchidananda is a place which has been realized and reached by thousands and thousands of yogis in the past, over thousands of years. So you can say the path has been charted. Say, going to the top of Mount Everest is difficult, but the method is known, the path is known. We know there's a way up to the top of Mount Everest, and so many people have done it before. But this is a mountain nobody has ever climbed before. Nobody knows that there's a way up. It looks like something up there, so there's no connection with it. So what took 10 years was not for him to go and do what other people have done. He hewed the path. He's the path. He's created the path. You know, it's one thing we go on the road from here to Pondi or somewhere else, and we go, it took 3 hours. It was very difficult. But I remember this East Coast road back in the 1970s, where it was like a dirt road full of potholes, and it took 7-8 hours to go because there was only the Tindivanam road was the main road at that time, and we only used it when the floods knocked out the main highway. But there was still a road. Imagine trying to go before there was a road, when there was jungle there, where there was crops and shrubs and buns everywhere. You have to create, he had to create the road. Now you can drive across the United States in 5 days or three and a half, 4 days, depending on how many hours a day you drive, just by the road. But originally it took the first people to go from the East Coast to the West Coast, it took 6 months to a year to go there, because there was no road. So Sri Aurobindo has created the road. That's what they came for. They've created, Mother and Sri Aurobindo have created the road to Supermind, and now they've given us the map. This chapter is giving us the road map and telling us of the stops along the way and the very interesting sights and experiences you can have as you journey there. He's written the guidebook. Life Divine is the guidebook. So higher mind is a mind of thought, but it's a mind of truth thought, not our thought, not our mental thoughts. And those truth thoughts only come when we stop thinking, when we try to silence the mind, when we give up saying, I know the right thing, just listen to me, or if give me a little time and I'll figure it out. And the nature of that thought when he says it's a truth thought, our thoughts are disconnected from each other. He has a thought by how he can help Lydia, Wickham, the Bennetts, Gardners, and everybody. His thought is no longer partial. It's a much wider thought. So the thoughts that come from above are not disconnected, isolated, and different. They're connected in such a way is that they are powerful for everybody. That's the higher mind. And these thoughts are powerful. My examples are not, I cannot claim that these examples are precise, because unless Sri Aurobindo has told us this comes from here and here, I'm only using it as illustration. But an example for me of a thought that comes from the higher mind or an idea from the higher mind is the idea of freedom. The word freedom is not only an idea, but it's a power. And when Sri Aurobindo and the freedom fighters said, we want complete freedom from India, it's a call. It's not just an idea. Oh, freedom means that you don't have another ruler or something like that. It's a call from the soul, which has a power to it. So the thoughts of the higher mind have a power to realize themselves. And when the American colonists, who were very proud of being part of the British Empire, like the India was, when they first got the idea, no, we're not being treated fairly, we're not being treated as equals, we want to be free. It was a call like that, a shock. It was a shock wave going through the society that woke people up or released their aspiration, said, yes, I want to be free. I want to be independent. I want to have rights of my own. So the thoughts from the higher mind have a power to them. The next level, the next plane, and the higher mind, he says, is the plane of the sage. The wise man. The wise man doesn't mean that he lives always on the higher mind, but the wisdom he gets comes to him as thoughts that come to his mind from above, not thoughts that he constructs out of his own mentality. So this is the person who's really stationed himself in the higher mind, looks to the world like the sage. He speaks wisely. He knows. You present something to him, he knows the solution.
A Russian website on Sri Aurobindo's teachings, there is a passage that quotes Mother saying that Nalini Kanta Gupta was a man who could read Sachidananda at will. The same mother says in Agenda that Nalini's mind was like cotton wool, impervious to vibrations. Now, how both statements could be true?
Okay, well, I'm not going to worry about explaining Nalini's too much. I'm not an expert on Nalini. But the very fact that Mother says that his mind was like cotton wool, but he could go to Sachidananda, it illustrates the point that the path to supermind, you can't go through a mind of cotton wool. The mind has to be developed. We have to rise beyond the powers of mind to higher mind. But Sachidananda is to go out of creation. It's to go to the transcendent. So it's like instead of climbing to Mount Everest, you simply jump off the cliff and you go very fast and very far somewhere else. So that's the difference. The yogis, the rishis who have gone for moksha have chosen to go out, to suspend the journey. It's like dropping out. Instead of finishing and going all the way to the end, they say, I don't need all of this. I just drop out. Then I don't have to have any exams. I don't have to worry about degrees and all of that. I don't have to pay bribes or fees to get in admission or anything like that. I won't care about all of this. So it's a different thing. What Ashok's question illustrates, the vast difference between the spirituality, not the spirituality of the Vedas or the Upanishads, but the spirituality that came with Advaita, how different it is when you decide to seek liberation of the soul rather than divinization of life. And it comes out beautifully in Savitri, because Aswapati, when he rises in his yoga, which is described in the poem, he's offered liberation. He's offered liberation, and he says, no, that's not what I want. I want this for everybody. I want this not up in a heaven. I want this on earth. I want this for all of humanity. I don't want my suffering to be removed. I want suffering to be removed for all. So it's a realization for the whole world, not just for the individual. And though I don't think this is very precise, Sri Aurobindo also suggests that many of the souls that opted for moksha, they find out afterwards they have to come back and complete the journey, because that's not really, they thought that the thing was moksha. Maybe some of them have gone out and completed it and chosen to go back and merge back into the one and dissolve their individuality. But he seemed to be saying most of them would end up finding out, okay, you had a nice vacation in moksha, but come back and do what you really are intended to do and what it's really meant for. This is the path that it's good. Because you have gone to moksha, you have proved to us, to the rest of us, that there's something called Satchitananda that we can reach. That's good. We need example. We need stories. We need some success stories to encourage us. But that's not the real goal now. So if higher mind is the truth thought, he says illumined mind is truth sight. Truth sight, truth vision. We know things not by a thought anymore. We know it as light. We know it as a vision. And if the sage is the person who's attained to the higher mind, the person who's attained to the illumined mind, he calls the seer or the mystic. He sees the truth rather than thinks it. There need be no thought in the mind. He doesn't know by a thought, either a thought from below or a thought from above. There's no thought. There's just the vision of it. Appa told me a story once. There was an engineer who had been his student long time ago, and that man came with a proposal, a business proposal, to start a company, and he asked Appa for what he thought of it, and Appa said that when he gave him the proposal, Appa saw mother's figure coming out of the proposal. He says, this will work. And that man built a very successful multi-crore company. An employed engineer became a successful entrepreneur. That comes from the illumined mind. It may come as a rare instance, or it may come as a regular, steady knowledge. The seer is one who knows everything that way, doesn't know it by thinking, knows it by those visions. So it's much more direct than a thought. It's not by a thought, it's a directly. It's not verbal. It doesn't come as a voice. And, you know, Sri Aurobindo spends a lot of time in this chapter, I was going to mention at the end, but I'll mention it here, telling us that as we go up, we have to be very careful, because it's very easy to confuse things and mistake things for the higher inspiration. He writes at length about it, about a third of the chapter is already on that. Even when we go for intuition, he says most of the things that we think are intuitions, he calls them pseudo-intuitions, false intuitions. They appear to us as intuitions, but they don't have that truth in them. He says that most of what comes to us, which we think is an intuition, is not really an intuition. It's a communication from another being who wants us to listen to him. So it's not so easy. It's not easy to get these things. It's not so easy to have the purity to distinguish the real truth that's coming from something that appears that way. Not everything that comes as a vision is true. Not everything that comes as a voice is true. That's why Mother says, that's why they insist, the first thing we should do is reach the psychic. Because the psychic is the center of truth. The psychic is not lured by pride or ego or self-importance or anything else. It knows the truth. So if we reach the psychic first, the psychic gives us a discrimination in order to tell what comes, whether it's true or whether it's something else. That's why Mother says sincerity is so important. When I have a thought or somebody tells me something that's very satisfying to me, I say, you're very intelligent. Yes, I think you're right. I know you're right. I know you're right because you're saying exactly what I want to hear. That's what Wickham did with Elizabeth. When Wickham met Elizabeth and Wickham understood that Elizabeth knows Darcy, and that Elizabeth is resentful of Darcy, Wickham very cleverly told her all the things that would make Darcy look bad and him look good. And about 90% of the things he told Lizzie were true. I grew up there. I was the godson of Mr. Darcy. He offered me a living. All those things were true. But it was the 10% deviation which made the whole thing false. And Lizzie didn't have that discrimination. She thought she was very intelligent. She was very intelligent. She didn't have that discrimination to tell what was true from the false. That's why Mother says sincerity is so important. Sincerity is to want the truth, not what's pleasant for me, what's flattering to me, what's convenient for me, what justifies me.
Sir, Ashokan sir asks, Einstein gave a formula for releasing energy from matter in the form of E is equal to mc square. Does integral yoga offer any such formula for releasing the spirit that is buried in matter?
What a great question. Well, I think Sri Aurobindo has given the whole formula in this book. That is exactly what he's given. Einstein gave a formula. It sounds very simple, but the process of releasing the energy in matter, humanity's been working for 100 years since he gave that formula in order to do it. And we find out most of the time all we're creating is explosions and dangers from it. So it's one thing to give a formula. It's another thing to release that power in a very positive way. Today, the nuclear energy, which Einstein was the first one who understood, that everything we think of as matter is really full of energy, an infinite energy. We didn't know that before. We thought energy comes from the sun, or energy is from magnetism or something like that, or from the fire. But even today, we struggle to use that energy effectively. To release that energy, we're very good at creating weapons that will destroy us. So it's one thing to know that it's there. It's another thing to really give. We don't have a safe way to release nuclear energy from the atom today without creating dangers. Maybe we've been lucky to avoid catastrophes in our nuclear plants and everything, but they're very, very inherently dangerous. So it's one thing to know the power is there. It's another to give a method. Imagine if nuclear energy can be made completely positive, which it's not today, then there's no need for energy. We have all the energy in the universe at our disposal. Everything will be free. because there's infinite energy, but we haven't figured that out yet. Sri Aurobindo has given that method for the evolution. What Einstein's doing in, at one level, at the physical level, he's given that, he's told us it's there. Sri Aurobindo is saying the answer to everything is there. Not just the answer to the needs for electricity or something like that. The answer to every power and all the knowledge we need is there. So if you want it in a short formula, I have to think about that. It's a really intriguing question. I've given one of Appa's formulas, aspiration plus rejection plus surrender. There are several that are like that, but like Einstein's formula, writing it down is easier than releasing all of the power that's in it. That's our work to be done. So anyway, a very intriguing question. So we've gone to higher mind, the truth thought, illumined mind, the truth light. Now we go to intuition. He calls it truth sight. Truth sight. And we're getting up very close to supermind now, because what the intuition shows is really truth, if it's real intuition, that is. He says the closest description of it is comes like lightning, but not an individual lightning, a mass of lightning that illumines, that reveals the truth of a wide part of reality, like a lightning flash bursting forth from the silence, not going from one point to another point, but revealing a whole. Illuminating the whole thing, like suddenly somebody's turned on the lights in the dark and we see what things are really like. He says supermind is still far off, but intuition is a very high power, and he says there are four powers of intuition. He describes them all in this passage on Savitri. There's a truth seeing, which is the power of revelation, when you see the truth of something. There's a truth hearing, which the English word is inspiration, when you hear the truth of something. There's a truth touch, where, and he doesn't mean touch that you touch it with your hand, when you come in contact with something, when we touch something, we come in contact with it. Oh, this is warm or smooth or hot or rough or whatever. When our consciousness comes in touch with something, it knows the essence of the thing that we've come in touch with. So if you have this, the truth touch, if you see a photo of somebody like Mother could, from the photo, she knows the person. Not just the behavior and all. She knows the psychic, the whole soul of the person, the whole being of the person. If you receive a letter from somebody, the whole person is communicated through the contact with them. And then the fourth one he calls an automatic discrimination. Even when we see a truth, it can be mixed with so many other things, but when this power comes of intuition, we see this truth in relation to every other truth. Instead of seeing it in isolation, we see how it's related to everything else, so it doesn't contradict anything else. So we're getting up to the levels where a verbal description doesn't help us very much. The poetic description would help us quite a lot. There's the Sri Aurobindo, when he was first came to Pondi before Mother came back, Mother had come back at that time. One of the earliest disciples was a famous lawyer named Dharasamy. He later became a disciple and he died in the ashram. He's the one who mother put it. He wanted mother. He was dying, and he asked mother to put her foot on his chest, and she did. And then he lived for a long time. That was him. He first came to Sri Aurobindo as a lawyer, a freedom fighter, and asked for Sri Aurobindo's opinion on a court case. He was a high court lawyer earning fabulous fees at that time. And he gave the brief to Sri Aurobindo, and Sri Aurobindo pointed to a particular place on the brief, and he said, here. And the man went and won the case and came back and said, how did you know that? How did you just put your finger on that? And Sri Aurobindo said, I saw a spot of light there. And the man offered lakh of rupees to Sri Aurobindo. This is in 1920. So it may be like crore or crores today, just for simply putting his finger on the spot. Sri Aurobindo said, no, I can't accept your money. The man protested, and he went to mother and insisted, and mother finally said, all right, you can give 10,000 rupees. That was the light of intuition, the truth seer. Sri Aurobindo says in one of his aphorisms that a yogi sitting in the Himalayas dreams of freedom, and the French Revolution breaks out, which became the beginning of democracy in Europe. He doesn't tell us that that's intuition, but I think that's an example of the power of intuition. It's not just an idea. It's an idea with power to change the whole world. So there's a passage in Savitri about Aswapati. I'm just going to read to you a few lines. It may not help, but it's a beautiful passage where inspiration is one of the powers of intuition. And he talks about oft inspiration with her lightning feet, a sudden messenger from the all-seeing tops, traversed the soundless corridors of his mind. It only comes when it's soundless here. Bringing her rhythmic sense of hidden things. A music spoke. So that's the voice, the sound of transcending mortal speech. A joy of light. A joy of sudden sight. A rapture of the thrilled undying word poured into his heart as into an empty cup. All knowledge packed into great wordless thoughts. How can you have wordless thoughts? All knowledge packed into great wordless thoughts. So he's trying to communicate. This is his experience of it as he went up, and he describes it through. And notice it's not just knowledge. It's knowledge that's thrilling with joy, thrilling with, filled with power. And the last part of this chapter, which is the overmind. We already studied overmind in part one, the last chapter on mind, supermind, overmind, Maya. But that was the overmind that's creating the world of division. Now we're going back to overmind on our way to supermind. He says, overmind is the plane of the gods. The gods, the highest gods, not the lower level beings and everything, but the highest gods, Krishna is the god of the overmind. Each of these gods really feels they are the supreme. They acknowledge all the others, but they really feel they are the supreme. Each of them is not aware that there's something higher above them in which they're all united and they're all one. They feel they are the truth. They are truth, but they are one ray of the truth, and the truth, the real truth, the supramental truth, the Ishwara, is all of them. They are all powers of the divine, like the colors of the rainbow are all aspects of the white light which spreads out in a rainbow effect. But each color thinks it's the color, it's the white. So when we get to the overmind, whether we see gods or not, whether we have knowledge in any form or not, whatever we see is really a truth, a powerful truth, but it's separate from all other truths. And we may see all of the truths, but we see them as independent of one another. So if we rise to the overmind heavens where the gods are, we'll see all the gods, and there's Lakshmi and Saraswati and all of these gods, and we're gods and goddesses, and we'll see they're all true. But they'll all seem to be separate to us. And if you go to overmind, you'll see philosophies. There are hundreds of philosophies of all different description. And they're all true. The materialist is true. The Advaita is true. Everything is true, but they're all separate from one another. They're not unified. And all the religions will be there. And each has found a part of the truth, but not the unity from which they all come. Everything you find in overmind is true, but it doesn't give you the truth consciousness because you don't see it in relationship to everything else. But it is so great. And in order to reach overmind, it's not enough that we have silenced the mind, that we have become very quiet and passive. And as you go up, he says, you have to become more and more still in order to allow the higher influence to come down and take birth and not interfere with it. So we have to become more and more quiet. He constantly emphasizes that, more and more still. But to go to overmind, that's not enough. You have to also be universal. The individual mind, where I really am still thinking of myself as separate, cannot go to overmind. Overmind is universal. You have to be in the cosmic consciousness. You have to know that the truth of your being is universal, not just individual, in order to go to this plane, because everything is there. No individual can encompass all of that.
In Thoughts and Aphorisms, he says there is hope for the man who has received God's touch and for the self-convinced atheists. But for the votaries of religion, they are dead souls who follow a death that they call living. Now, where does this statement leave devotees of Sri Aurobindo and Mother?
Well, look, this is not just devotees. What is it? Why does he say there's hope for the atheist? Because the atheist says, I don't know. And why is there hope for the person of spiritual experience? Because he knows there's something more beyond, and he wants to attain it. The problem with religion is when we think we know all the answers, and all I have to do is believe it. And that's what the religions teach us. They teach us to accept, all I have to do is keep these beliefs and follow the rituals, and I'm there. That person has essentially decided to stop where they are. All progress comes. That's the message of the first chapter of the book. Don't stop in the middle. No matter how great the knowledge is, there's something beyond. Understanding life divine is good. It's good, but understanding it is only a step. We should practice it. We should realize it. We should discover it. The atheist at least is one who says, I don't know, and is seeking. He may be totally ignorant, but he knows he's ignorant. The person who's an ardent advocate of a religion thinks, I know everything, please listen to me. And I will save you, and if you do what I'm doing, you'll be saved. It's the belief that they have arrived at the totality. The truth is, we have arrived at the totality only when it has become real in our consciousness, and that means until we get to supermind, and even then, it's not the end. We can continue to grow in consciousness after that. So you could substitute and say, the person who's ignorant and knows he's ignorant, or is discontent and knows he's discontent, but the person is there's hope. But for the person who thinks they have all the answers, or is satisfied with it, it's a long thing. Another way of saying the same thing. And that can happen at any level. If you get a truth thought in the higher mind, or a truth light in the illumined mind, or a truth lightning flash in the and if somebody makes the mistake, if you're misfortunate enough for somebody to say, oh, what you said is very wise, you're a great sage or a rishi, finished. The moment people start calling us sage or rishi, we know we're in trouble, we better run away. because the moment we become proud and satisfied and think that we know what everybody else doesn't know, we stop growing. The more we grow, the more we feed a Shrivindo, the more we realize how much we have to do and how much we have to discover and how far we have to go. I think that's the essence of that aphorism.
So we're in the almost end. I'm going to end in 5 minutes so that we want to hear from Chandru, but it's very difficult to illustrate these things unless Sri Aurobindo says this comes from the intuition or this comes from something else. But I was talking with Appa to try to get an example. What would it be at the overmind consciousness? You know the story when the Pandavas take the mango from the tree of that saint or that rishi. When they find out that they'll be cursed if the rishi comes and finds out that they've taken his one mango a day, it comes on the tree. And Krishna tells them, or somebody tells them, I don't remember, that unless you, if you want to restore the mango to the tree, you have to tell absolute truth. No? And so all of the Pandavas in turn try to say something that's true, and each one, as they speak a truth, the mango goes up into the air, up to the tree, but it's still hanging in midair. And finally, at last, it comes to Draupadi, and I think she also says something, and the mango even starts to fall down again, and then she changes her answer and says, no, the truth is that whenever I see Karna, I feel powerfully attracted to him. And then the mango goes onto the tree. That's the power of truth. And, you know, if you see how many times truth comes in Life Divine, it comes on every page 10 times. And Mother in her saying, she's constantly saying, but to really understand the power of truth is maybe if we've really understood that, we don't need anything else. And Mother was constantly giving it in her messages. I think it was about 1960 she wrote, truth or the abyss. And she was writing this to the disciples in the ashram. The choice is truth or the abyss. Meaning anything less than the truth is the falsehood. It can never lead to what we want. It can never lead to what we aspire for. So that is, and overmind affirms the truth. Everything we see there is true. Only thing is, it's partial. And what we need is a truth that doesn't exclude anything else.
Sir?
Yes.
Ashokan sir asks, the emergence of mind and ego formation seem to be unavoidable in the course of evolution. Now, how can we find fault with what is unavoidable in evolution?
There's no fault in ego any more than there's a fault for the child who wets its bed or wets its clothes or spills the food and can't drink or feed itself. There's no fault for anything that we do in the process of growing up, of being ignorant or foolish. All of those things are things to be outgrown. But if the child at the age of 40 says, I can't make my own bed, or if an adult woman says, I can't cook, mommy has to cook for me, or if we insist on what was valid for us as children should be there for our whole life, somebody should take care of me, somebody should do this and that, we are refusing to make the progress that it's natural for us to make. The ego is a necessary stage in our evolution, and sure, it's a long topic, I won't repeat it now, but he stresses it's a very important stage in the development of the individual. It's not a bad thing in itself. But when it's time to outgrow it to go on, it will cause us more and more problems the more we insist on it. Now we want progress beyond a certain level. We don't expect that of the child. We don't expect the child to have the maturity or the sense of responsibility or the skill or the dexterity or wisdom of an older person. But if we want to continue to be a child all our life, we can expect our problems to keep growing over time. Our problems today come to tell us it's time to go beyond the ego. Sri Aurobindo's not condemning the ego. As you say, it is a creation of the spirit for a purpose. Just like the animal consciousness was a creation, just like mind is a creation. We're not criticizing mind by saying that it's not the ultimate truth. We see where we get with mind. We have lots of problems. It's given us lots of benefits. It's also left us with lots of problems. Now the question is, how do we go beyond and solve all our problems and get much more that's waiting for us? We can't do that through the ego, which is selfish and separate and thinks only of itself. We have to practice. We have to come to the law of surrender. We have to give ourselves. We have to practice self-giving. We have to discover our unity with everybody else. We can't be every man for himself or every woman for himself and realize the divine life. We can only realize it when we discover the divinity in everybody else around us. That's the sincerity required. I think you're going to enjoy the second half of this talk because Chandru's been doing a lot of research, so I will turn it over to him.